Today's guest, author, speaker, and business philosopher, Krish Dunham. You're listening to the Eagles Talent Podcast. This podcast is brought to you by Eagles Talent Speakers Bureau, for speakers who inspire, educate, and entertain. You can find us online at eaglestalent.com. Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Eagles Talent Podcast. I'm your host, Sheldon Senek. Remember, you can listen to our podcast on our website or on the go at iTunes. Simply type Eagles Talent in the iTunes search. If you're interested in bringing any one of the speakers we have as guests on our podcast, you can do so by visiting us online at eaglestalent.com. Do you wonder if the American dream is still alive and well? To speaker Krish Dunham, it is. Krish and I recently sat down together to talk about pride, self-growth, business, family, and, well, America. Krish Dunham, welcome to the Eagles Talent Podcast. So glad you can join us. Thank you so much.
Oh, thanks for having me. It's always a blast.
Krish, you certainly are an inspirational speaker, but more than that, after listening to your presentations and reading your book, American Dream from an Indian Heart, you're really offering more. Would it be fair to say you're helping to provide keys for personal growth?
To that degree, yes. I think over the years, the nomenclature of motivational speaker as a tagline for me has changed. Uh-huh. I'm now more called a business philosopher because I do address the 24-hour champion mindset, which is I teach them the skills necessary to make a living, but I also show with them the will that allows them to shape a life. And that way they can combat some of the demotivation that exists in arenas when they're not preparing for them. So I think business philosopher that is probably a more apt way in which I look at what I do.
So you're a native of India, and you arrive in the United States in 1986, I think. With,
that's right.
If I'm correct, $9 in your pocket. Correct me if I'm wrong, but you had a desire to come to the U.S. long before that, right?
Yeah, my dad worked for an American company in India, and I grew up with a bunch of the kids who would come and visit the homes of their parents. I mean, their parents were expats in India. So I grew up with a lot of American friends mm-hmm. who would tell me the stories of the country that they lived in, but they were just visiting India to be with their parents for a holiday or something. And that coupled with the fact that every Sunday night in this little place my dad worked, they would screen American movies. So I grew up idolizing John Wayne and imitating his accent in a young way. And, so I had a desire to come to this country when I was 8 years old.
So what was your parents' reaction when you wanted to fulfill this dream?
Well, being the youngest in the house, my brother is obviously older than me, but my dad was very encouraging of it, but he did something which I thought was fascinating, which I today share with the people I talk to. Mm-hmm. My dad said, when you get there, not if, I want you to hit the ground running. So my father forced me to study American history and American identities while I was still in India, where course curriculum already had Indian history and European history. Mm-hmm. So when I landed in America, technically I knew more about her background than unfortunately most of the people who lived here. So competing became easy right. because I already knew what I had to do before I got here.
Wait, and what do you remember as your biggest struggle when you arrived in the U.S.?
Well, overcoming the wow factor, because I had never seen a vending machine or a drive-through till I got here. So some of the things that were designed to give convenience, I was just mesmerized by. And very quickly, I had to overcome the fact that there is a huge difference between necessity and convenience. And if you get trapped in the fact that you think convenience is a need, then you're going to operate one way. And so I had to self-motivate myself to say, okay, some of these things are just the luxury of living here, but I can't take them for granted.
Right. A few years later, in 1991, you won a sales contest and a ticket to a seminar conducted by Zig Ziglar. Can you talk about how this opportunity impacted your life?
Well, as a sales contest, actually, there's a funny thing about that. I wanted to win the contest to get the money. my boss said that he had taken the money and bought a ticket, and which I thought was rude. But the seminar had two people doing a 6-hour event in Dallas. One was Brian Tracy and the other was Zig Ziglar. But the option, because of the price, we could either buy both tickets or buy one for a little less. So my boss said, okay, you can only go to either one of them. And here's how history, is fascinating when you look back at the reason I made the choice. I had already known three Brians. I never knew anybody named Zig. So I said, I'll go to that Zig fellow. And 3 hours later at the Irving Calvary Temple in Irving, Texas, on January 26th of 1990 is when I went to hear him speak.
Oh, okay.
My life changed. I learned more in 3 hours from this man than I had in all of my collegiate education. And I still have the notes, which I took handwritten notes, about 8 pages, The Power of Dreams. But he had some simple and amazing concepts. For example, he said something which I thought was borderline scandalous when he said, if you treat your wife like a thoroughbred, you won't end up with a nag. And I thought, I said, wow, I can't believe he gets away with stuff like this. But then pull back the curtain on the colloquialisms he used, there was a great amount of wisdom and intellect there.
Krish, in your book, American Dream from an Indian Heart, which was published, I believe, in 2008, you showcase how the American Dream is still alive and well. Right. You set up the book from the beginning, and I quote, at times, the suggestions will come across as harsh, and I ask for the forgiveness of the reader. I do hope that this book will inspire you to think individually and restore yourself the hopes, dreams, and the ambitions that were an integral part of your own innocence. You know, what really fascinates me about this book, and tell me if I'm reading too much into it, but it's very much, to me, post 9/11 book, and we're certainly in a different America than before 9/11. How much of that went through your mind?
Well, the book, obviously, the writing of it began before 9/11. It got published afterwards because I tell people, the best success is a 13-year overnight success. So, but one of the things that you mentioned in that very statement you read was somewhere along the line, the American dream stopped being viewed through the lens of innocence, grandeur, and wonder. We have perverted our definitions of some of the basic tenets of humanity. And as a result, when you don't have innocence and wonder, it's very hard to have gratitude. You get angry, you get bitter, and that's, we have a great divide going on right now between have and have not and all of this other issue. But I think if we go back to the innocence of the fact that it is still a free nation, I jokingly tell people, I said, America is too young to have problems. Most of her antiques are plastic. I mean, India, the Taj Mahal was completed in 1671. So from a civilization standpoint, America is the combined result of the borrowed graces of some of the great minds of this world who traveled here over the years. And so I still look at it through that innocence. And I still have the wow factor when I go through the checks at the airport. And the other day I went through one of those intrusive pat-downs which you read about. And it is very uncomfortable. And as I was getting angry, I realized, hey, in a little bit, this man will still be here having to put up with other people's opinion. Right. I'll be in the front of the plane being addressed as Mr. Dunham.
Right.
So gratitude, innocence, these are the things I think which we are losing in this post 9/11 world.
Well, and that brings me to perspectives. And I'd love to read another quote. And I really love this. A man looked at a peanut, caught a vision of a better world, and spent the rest of his life devoted to the possibilities of a peanut. In another part of the same world, someone was probably looking at the peanut with the sole objective of overcoming hunger by eating it. And the question I have is, do you think we can forget that there are other perspectives besides our own?
And that's it, you know. There's an old adage that if two people agree on everything, one of them is unnecessary. And you know, I had a boss one time who used to work at IBM in his previous life. He said, "Opinions are like belly buttons. Everyone's got one." And that's what makes it fun. That's what makes it fascinating within the genre of motivational speaking that I categorize myself under. There are many different styles, but what happens is it doesn't mean one is wrong, one is right, one is worse, one is better. That's for evaluations. The desire to do something has to begin with the fact that you're privileged enough to do it. You know, the knowledge is learned, wisdom is lived. And I think sometimes we get trapped up in the knowledge side of it than on the wisdom side of it.
One thing I immediately get from you is how important family is, whether you're talking about your parents or your son. Does society sometimes get caught up in defining who we are by our work life?
Absolutely. And I think, you know, most people, if you ask them at the end of their journey, where would they spend more time? Nobody said they spend it at work. And that's part of this 24-hour mindset. The will, the skill is necessary to make a living so you can feed and provide comfort and happiness and all of the hierarchical needs we need. But the will is also needed in order to enjoy that journey. If my boy ever asked me, you know, he says, "Dad, if you had given me the advice you give freely all over the world, my life would not have been the series of tragedies it's turned out to be." You know, I'd be a brokenhearted father because what's happening is then I'm defining success by my press clippings. And this came from Mr. Ziegler. His advice to me was, he said, "Son, don't believe your good press any more than you react to your bad press."
Keep balanced, right?
And he also added, he said, "It's not all relative." He said, "If you put one foot in boiling hot water and the other foot in ice cold water," he said, "on average, you're miserable." He says, so there is a right and there is a wrong. There is a code by which you have to operate. And so I put family first. Usually when people say, "Where are you going next?" jokingly, I say, I'm going home. I just have to stop off in St. Louis along the way."
The word pride, you have a formula for this. Personal recognition instills in me a desire for excellence. Can you briefly explain this?
Yeah, pride, you know, and we're talking about a healthy self-pride. The false pride that is vanity is pretty prevalent. You open any magazine and they'll tell you what to look like, what to eat, how to dress, and how to think. But there is a self-pride that says, "I am the captain of my own ship. I'm the author of my destiny to some degree." But more importantly, what I want to do is I want to begin my life as an entrepreneur. I want to believe that I'm the president of this enterprise I have. And that allows me to have that personal recognition that instills in me a desire for excellence, which means I begin with the idea that I'm going to be excited about what I get to do, not because I'm doing it, but that I'm privileged enough to do it. And there's a huge difference. In a book, Top Performance, that I had the privilege of being a contributing author with Mr. Ziegler, we articulated that 97% of the people operate in the comfort zone. They're good people, but 3% of the people operate in the effective zone. And effective zone thinkers begin with what I believe is a personal recognition saying, "I'm going to recognize myself before society recognizes me."
Here's one last passage from your book that absolutely punched me into reality. Human rationalization that we all deserve better is falsely founded in the belief that we were all born equals and man has somehow fouled up the grand equation. While this statement says many things, it says to me, dreams don't always happen the way we want it to. And sometimes I don't think we take enough responsibility. Rather, we consistently find ways to fault conditions, society, or others. How can we change that thinking, or can we?
Well, I think there are two narratives that come out of that thought process. And one is the fact that if you ask people globally, and I have, would you want fairness or equality? Everybody says fairness. I just want a fair shot. I know the game is already in play. I know the rules have already been written. Just let me get a chance to play the game and prove my mettle. Yet all of society's laws are based on equality. So what happens is we try to lower the bar and level the playing field, and that way what we do is we take away the drive of those that want to. And the people who don't want to really don't have any drive because you've lowered the bar to meet them where they are. Everybody's saying they want fairness, but all of society's standards. Now, equality is a good thing in terms of it's a utopian concept, but in reality, it doesn't happen. There are 7 billion people who will walk this planet during our lifetime, and there's not another just like us. We're all unique.
Right.
But I love how Cabot Robert put it one time. He says 80% of the people in this world don't care that you have a problem. The other 20% glad it's you. So to each his own. The second narrative that comes about this equality and fairness, and I push the envelope, but I always try to explain the physiology behind my thought process.
Okay.
You may agree with me, you may disagree with me, but at least you'll know that I've done my research and here's why I stand where I do.
Right.
If my father had complained on the steps of the British, of the municipality in India, and demanded restitution for something he didn't know about or whatever, my life would have been different.
Uh-huh.
But I saw my father work very hard. My dad studied under a streetlight. My mother was a child bride, married to him at 14, brother at 17, me at 20, okay? Mm. I don't come from a Harvard background. I don't come from a mountaintop experience. I tell people if it didn't cost but a dime to get out of sight, most of my family couldn't have gone anywhere, you know?
Right.
The reality is I saw in my father an ability to look at problems and then say, problems can only be addressed when you take responsibility. When you expect a solution and are not part of it, that's not problem solving. You're just a spectator. And in America, we unfortunately fall victim to this. And I'll give you an analogy without trying to rant too much.
Mm-hmm.
But my spiritual mentor, Dr. Ramesh Richard, put it this way. He said, every American sporting event is almost a mirror image of life. He says it consists of 75,000 people desperately in need of exercise, yelling at 22 people desperately need a rest. And if that isn't a mirror of life, I don't know what is. But that's what you see, you know. There's a large percentage of people. And in the book also I write, I said, the insult to our intelligence is not that we are asked to stand in line. The affront to our dignity is when we're told which line to stand in and how much you deserve.
You talk about why people love America so much. And many think it's just the freedom. But to you, it goes deeper than that, and it's about the opportunity to have faith in that freedom.
Right.
Can you talk a little more about that?
Well, yeah, it's the only nation which allows you to come from anywhere else and call yourself American.
Mm-hmm.
My son was born here. My bride was born here before she moved back to India when she was 2. So I'm the only person who was born in another country of the 3 family of Americans, but we all call ourselves American.
Mm.
I don't believe in the nomenclature or the hyphenated definition because this is where we choose to live.
Mm-hmm.
But I've been to France. You can be there 9 generations. You cannot call yourself French.
Right.
You can go to Germany and be there forever. You cannot call yourself German. Their national identity is rooted in the DNA and the authenticity of geography.
Mm-hmm.
America is an ideal. 9/11 shattered that ideal because for the first time we were threatened on our borders. But for the most of her existence, I mean, Patrick Henry stood up and pled for this country at the St. John's Church. But he was a first-generation immigrant. His father had migrated from Scotland.
Mm-hmm.
But what happens was very quickly when you come into the geography that is America, there is almost a decision that people make. You either love her or you hate her maybe hate may be a strong word.
Mm-hmm.
But there's nobody who's ambivalent to America globally.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I equate this to, I said, American identity is like people going to a Red Sox-Yankees game. Nobody there is hoping for a tie.
Right.
You know, that blood runs deep. And I said, that's what it is. So when I travel worldwide and I see people bashing America, I look at them and I say, listen, you know, most people who don't like her already live there. And so for me, having faith in that freedom is not the theological faith, though that is another component that mm-hmm. built this country. It is just do you believe in the men and women who give us the opportunity to have dissent?
Hmm.
You know, no other country can you have people arguing on TV like our, you know, brilliant people do.
Right.
It's just a very unique, unique place in time and space.
Hmm. So, when organizations and companies ask you to speak, what are some of the key points you most commonly find yourself sharing?
There are a few threads that are standard in almost every other speech title. They may ask you to tailor some things to their specific requirements, but my backbone typically consists of, and I get this from a few friends who I consult with, but every time I talk, I always talk about a foundation which has six questions. Who are you? Where do you come from? Whom do you credit with what you've become? What makes you laugh? What makes you cry? And what gives you hope? And I call these the foundational questions that if you have the answer to, you'll succeed. After the foundation, we talk about the definition, which is once you understand on what you're going to stand, how are you going to define what you're going to do on that pedestal? Once you do the definition, then the goals and the expansion begin, not before. Mr. Ziegler used to say, when passion is born, you get a glimpse of your potential. Don't wait for all your ducks to line up before you get on the day shift. It doesn't happen that way. And then finally, conclusion. I also talk about this quite a bit in the sense that none of us set goals looking backwards, saying, how do I know I have finished well? And off late after this movie, The Bucket List came out, I've been using that to some degree by saying, most people will go to their grave with their music still within them. Oliver Wendell Holmes said that. And the reason they do that is they don't have a bucket list. And the bucket list has to be outlandish. It has to be something you cannot even imagine that you would be a possibility for you. 1991, 92 timeframe, when I went to my first Ziegler seminar after I started working for him, I wrote down a goal, 50, 50, 50. By the time I was 50, I wanted to have been in all 50 states and in 50 countries. At that point, I'd been in about three countries, and I had no more idea than a goat how the rest was going to happen. But here we are, 47 states, 55 countries. I'll be 50 in January, and you know, the other three states I'll probably just do as a trip later on this year. But it did become a reality. When I go back and look at that sheet of paper which I wrote on 1991, I was scared out of my mind to even have the desire to write that. But someone planted in me saying, you know, think things that are out of sight, not out of mind, just out of sight. Have quantity in your desire. So these are all the things I bring into the picture. Bottom line is they go back and look at my background, and you know, I tell people self-praise is half scandal, but Dizzy Dean said it ain't bragging if you've done it. So it's.
Krish, you are extremely inspiring and insightful. And I so enjoy your content as a speaker, a writer, and business philosopher, and truly love the passion you have for your family. So, Krish, thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me, Sheldon.
Thank you so much again for listening. I've been your host, Sheldon Sinek, and this is the Eagles Talent Podcast.